Does air pollution have anything to do with psychosis in adolescents?
Do physicians with malpractice claims change their practice?
How have very preterm infant outcomes changed?
And stem cells not helpful in treating heart failure?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on March 29th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And this week, I'd like to turn straight to JAMA Psychiatry. This thing I served up, gosh, what does air pollution have to do with psychotic experiences during adolescence? This actually educated me, and of course, I'm always happy to be educated with a new term, and that was urbanicity. So, this paper starts out with the statement that urbanicity is a well-established risk factor for both clinical and subclinical expressions of psychosis, which I had no idea that that was the case. What this study did was attempt to look at, okay, what factors relative to urbanicity, the density of the population and so forth, might be involved with that. So it turns out that in the UK, they have this thing called the Environmental Risk Longitudinal Twin Study. In this case, they have 2,200 plus kids who were born between 1994 and 1995 in England and Wales, and they've been followed from birth through 18 years of age. Pretty powerful. I also thought it was really interesting that at 18 years of age, these participants were privately interviewed regarding their adolescent psychotic experiences. And then they also correlated that with urbanicity that was estimated using 2011 census data. Basically, what they found here is that exposures to nitric oxide and nitric dioxide were associated with increased odds of psychotic experiences. And they also took a look at particles and different particle sizes, which are also a component of air pollution, and didn't really find that that same association was true. They speculate that it could be neuroinflammation as a result of these exposures that may be the mechanism by which the psychotic episodes are increased.
This contributes to the growing evidence that now links air pollution to a number of psychiatric disorders, things like anxiety, depression, autism spectrum disorder, and even Alzheimer's-like diseases. We know that urbanicity has contributed to these psychotic experiences, but by their estimates, the nitrogen dioxide and nitrogen oxides together explain about 60% of the association between urban residency and adolescent psychotic experiences.
And that's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I sort of wonder what made them even consider this as a hypothesis to begin with. A lot of the other things, the more I'm going to call them physical things, like increased asthma episodes and increased myocardial infarction in adults, these make some sense to me. But I'm just wondering, I wonder how they ever thought of this.
They had laboratory evidence from postmortem studies and from biopsies that pollution actually, as you mentioned, led to neuroinflammation and also to neurotoxicity. And we know that in youngsters, in their developing neural system, they're particularly sensitive to these things. And so it wasn't just out there, but it's based upon some pretty strong evidence that pollution, especially in kids, could contribute both to neuroinflammation and neurotoxicity, that is, death of neural cells.
Of course, the facile conclusion here is air pollution is bad. We need to minimize our exposures to it. I'm wondering if there are other strategies in the short term that people can take to help ameliorate these problems.
That's an interesting question. Obviously, this study doesn't address it. Fortunately, even though this is a harbinger of frank psychosis later in adulthood, few of these kids actually progress from these psychotic experiences to that. But again, another good reason why we need to minimize pollution.
Let's turn to which of the two of yours would you like to choose first?
Let's talk about this physician practice and malpractice. I thought this was a pretty interesting study because it begs the question, when physicians have multiple malpractice claims filed against them, do they in fact change their practice to a different geographic location, thereby protecting themselves? I've wondered that myself. So what these authors did to address that, they linked data from the National Practitioner Data Bank, that's where every malpractice claim across the United States is filed, with the Medicare Data Provider Practice and Specialty data set. So they merged those two to create a national cohort of almost 500,000 physicians between the ages of 35 to 65 who practiced over a seven-year period between 2008 and 2015. A total of 89% of physicians during that seven-year period had no claims. About 9% had one claim filed against them, and about 2% had two or more claims. And by the way, that small group of physicians, that 2%, accounted for nearly 40% of all claims. What they discovered was that having malpractice claims increased the odds of the physician leaving practice. For example, if he had one claim, about 8% of those physicians, or 9%, would leave practice. If he had multiple claims, five or more, 45% increased risk. But it wasn't associated with geographic relocation. Now, they were more likely, however, to go to a smaller practice, especially those with five or more claims.
This, we need to mention, of course, was in the New England Journal of Medicine. I guess I'm interested in your speculation that physicians do move around if they're involved in lots of malpractice claims. Has that been your previous experience?
I've always wondered about that, because when you sit, especially when you're recruiting physicians and physicians move from place to place and you know which may or may not have malpractice claims, you wonder, gosh, is this a problem? And by the way, if I'm the public, I'm worried about the same thing. Are the physicians and or hospital systems policing themselves well enough so bad physicians or physicians deliver poor care, are they moving around the country and going undetected? And this would suggest that that in fact is not the case.
All right, so we're going to rest on that good news then, and also the good news that, in fact, the vast majority of physicians don't have any malpractice claims at all.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the ones that do kind of hit the headlines, but it's nice to know that most physicians are interested and do deliver good quality care.
Let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a study taking a look at neonatal outcomes in kids who are born early in gestation in Sweden. All right, so why are we looking at Sweden? Well, Sweden, of course, turns out to be a really great model because they have such really powerful medical records. This was a comparison of two birth cohorts in Sweden that included 2,200 plus births at 22 to 26 weeks of gestational age. They took a look at one-year survival among those born alive, and they also took a look at a number of other outcomes that are common among preterm births. Their one conclusion was that one-year survival after extremely preterm birth improved from that time period of 2004 to 2007 compared with 2014 to 2016. So that's not surprising. All of the dire outcomes that are typically associated with preterm birth, and I'm not going to list them all, were reduced except for necrotizing enterocolitis. They also took a look at some of the comparators in other countries and more or less saw the similar trends, that there was a decline in mortality and improvements in overall survival. But they say this is still begs the question of recommendations on management of extremely preterm births. They're not consistent internationally at all. I'm wondering, do we really need international consistency? I don't know about that. Certainly you and I have talked about what should we do with extremely preterm infants and what about the resources that are necessary in order to keep them alive.
The interesting thing about the results from Sweden is they're among some of the best in the world. This study involves very young children, and it wasn't too long ago, and it's still true, by the way, in many developing countries, that the lower limits of viability for a preterm child was about 28 weeks. But they focused on kids that were 22 to 26 weeks. So these are really small kids. Because of limited resources, unfortunately, many countries won't be able to attain this for a period to come. The other issue this doesn't address is, what's the long-term outcome of these children? Their long-term maturity and future and chronic health problems, and how well do they do in an emerging society? So we'll need more studies about the outcome of these kids.
Agreed. But still, good news, I guess, that outcomes are improving.
Yes, indeed. Elizabeth, let's talk about the last thing, about stem cells for heart failure.
Okay, stem cells, of course, that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And for a number of years, we've been enamored with the use of stem cells to try to improve people that have heart failure, either because of ischemia, they've had a heart attack, or even because of result of infections or genetic abnormalities. The thought being is you could take a stem cell that is a very early, immature cell, put it into the heart, and it would develop into a heart cell that would improve function. Now, studies have shown that that probably doesn't happen, and as those stem cells probably don't become mature heart cells. But there was some hope that there were factors or proteins that were elicited from them that caused the surrounding heart cells to improve their function. These are called paracrine effects. And in small studies, it suggested this may be the case. So based upon those small preliminary studies, these investigators at 19 different centers around North America did a phase 2 clinical trial involving patients that had advanced heart failure. They were on a left ventricular assist device. In these individuals, about 161, they randomized them to injections of stem cells directly into the heart muscles or placebo injections. And they did it in a 2-to-1 randomization, that is twice as many patients received stem cells as received placebo. And they followed them over a course of a year. Even though these individuals received injections of 150 million stem cells derived from the bone marrow, it did not improve their weaning from the left ventricular assist device, and unfortunately it did not improve their survival.
I think we are not anywhere really with regard to the utility of stem cells in lots of different clinical applications right now.
They really don't morph into cardiac cells. They thought they might have some other effects that improve the outcome. This study is a long line of studies that have actually been pretty disappointing. The reason why I think this is important is despite the fact there's lack of an evidence base for stem cells, there are at least 570 businesses in the United States that offer stem cell therapy, and at least 61 of these are marketed to individuals with heart failure. So this is not approved by the FDA, and it hasn't shown to be beneficial as well. Our listeners need to be aware of this.
Absolutely. I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to start to understand some of these pathways and be able to say, here's what we need to do in order to make this thing viable. But I think for right now, we just don't have that.
Elizabeth, I think you summed it up well. Even though you understand the pathways, moving it into clinical studies to test it, that's really an important piece of this. And this is a very, very well done study.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.